Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This episode of True Murder is brought to you by Nature Box. Nature Box ships tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, like Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps, pistachio power clusters, and Big Island pineapple, you'll never get bored of snacking ever again. Try Nature Box for free by going to naturebox.com/truemurder. That's naturebox.com/truemurder. Susan Berman grew up in Las Vegas luxury as the daughter of Davey Berman, casino mogul and notorious mafia leader. After her father died, she learned about his mob connections. Susan then dedicated her life to learning about Vegas and its underworld chiefs. Her life took a bizarre turn in 1982 when Kathy Durst, the wife of her good friend Robert Durst, mysteriously disappeared. Durst was a prime suspect, but the case was never solved. After the Kathy Durst case was reopened, the DA was about to question Susan Berman about what she knew regarding a phone call Kathy supposedly made to her medical school dean saying she was sick and wouldn't be at school. That call was placed the day after she had vanished. Soon after the Kathy Durst case was reopened, Susan Berman was found dead, shot in the back of the head. No forced entry, no robbery, nothing missing from her home. The book covers what led to Durst's capture. Police records placed him in California at the time of his good friend Susan Berman's murder. HBO filmmakers discovered a letter unknown before, written by Durst to Susan, a dead-on match to the cadaver letter police say the killer sent before Susan's body was discovered. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder of a Mafia Daughter, the story behind the suspicions Robert Durst murdered Susan Berman, with my special guest, journalist and author, Kathy Scott. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Kathy Scott.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Dan.
Well, thank you very much. Again, Robert Durst is making you look good again. So this is fascinating how this case stays in the public's attention, always garnering more new interest because the story keeps unfolding. Let's get right to Susan Berman, because we've got to cover a lot of ground here to cover these new developments. So let's talk about Susan Berman. And before we talk about how Susan Berman met her good friend Robert Durst, tell us a little bit about Susan Berman and growing up in the shadow or under her father being Davey Berman. So tell us a little bit about Susan Berman and her life.
Her dad started out in Kansas City, New York, places like that, as a member of the mafia, Jewish mob, basically. He worked for Meyer Lansky, and he was tapped to go into Las Vegas and run the skim at the Riviera and later the Flamingo Hotel. And in 1946, he moved Susan and her mother, Gladys, who was a dancer. They moved, lived at the Ranchito Hotel. Susan was a year old, and she was raised as a mob royalty and had just an incredible life. And you know, the day Bugsy Siegel was killed, Davey Berman, Susan's father, took over running the scam at the Flamingo Hotel. And she just, they would go to Los Angeles and eat at the best place and stay at the, you know, Beverly Hilton and the Bel Air and places like that. And she just was a spoiled, very happy little girl. And then her father died during surgery when she was 12. And her mother committed suicide the next year when she was 13. And she went to live with her uncle Chicky, who worked for her father, but then no longer worked for the mob once he died. And he took her home to Idaho, where his wife and kids were. And then Susan went to Chadwick High School with Liza Minnelli and, you know, Children of Stars, and then went on to college. So that's basically Susan. So Susan, it never got over losing her parents, and but went into journalism, became a writer.
Right. So she's eventually ends up at UCLA in California, and she meets Robert Durst. Tell us about Robert Durst and his background before we talk about how they, Susan and Robert Durst, met and how their relationship developed. So tell us a little bit about the background of Robert Durst.
Well, Robert Durst is the oldest son to the Durst organization and Seymour Durst, who, you know, built half of Manhattan, all the high rises, the early ones that were built by the Durst organization. They're worth in the billions, that's with a B. And he was raised, like Susan, in the lap of luxury. And he lost his mother at age 7 when she either jumped or fell off the roof of their home. And then, he was raised in, I call him Bobby Durst because that's what Susan called him, but Durst was raised in Scarsdale, New York. Finest schools, finest prep schools, finest everything, and slowly went into working for his dad. But he did run, he married in 1973, I believe, he married Kathy Durst, who was in medical school. And he for a time ran a Vermont health food store, and then went back because he was tapped to one day take over the Durst organization. But Bobby wasn't interested. He was quiet in high school. He was always sort of an oddball, whereas his brothers were outgoing, his younger brothers, I think he had two of them. And Bobby was just all, people thought he was quiet, but he was, you know, still waters run deep. But he was quiet in more of a mysterious way, I think, than, you know, and you could say sinister too. I mean, I think he's sociopathic. I think it started with his childhood. So he was raised by a father who was distant. So he didn't get the nurturing, you know, at a young age because his mother died. So in that way, he and Susan had parallel sadness and loss in their lives and didn't fully mentally and emotionally grow the way they should have.
As well, we want to explain the dynamic with this Seymour Durst family in that Bobby Durst is the oldest. His youngest brother is Douglas, and there's a couple other siblings. And with reports that at around 10 years of age, they were seeing a psychiatrist for sibling rivalry, and they noticed some, they said, almost schizophrenic tendencies and some disturbing characteristics that he had at a very young age, and also how affected he was by his mother's death, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And yeah, he and his brother never get along. I mean, I come from a family of 5. Trust me, there are lots of fights. But so I understand the sibling rivalry thing when you're growing up. But he was different. Bobby was different. And it was, you know, it's interesting because his attorney now is claiming that he has Asperger's. And, you know, back then you didn't hear much about Asperger's. I mean, you know, Bobby Durst is 70, just had his 72nd birthday in jail, and thank you very much. But he, so it's interesting his attorney's latching onto that. But so there were, you know, back then in those, what did he grow up, the 40s, the 50s, psychiatry was, I mean, that's when they were still shocking people. So they certainly didn't have a handle back then, you know, the psychiatric community on what makes people tick necessarily. I mean, it was the same era that the Kennedy family, one of the daughters had a lobotomy, and then they, you know, felt bad for the rest of their lives that they had done that to her because that was one of the treatments. So Durst was diagnosed with lots of things, but he was basically showing signs very young, if you look at all the symptoms and signs of sociopath, you know, as being a sociopath. He had definitely a personality disorder.
Just for our audience, what is Asperger's syndrome?
Well, Asperger's, I mean, I worked with somebody who had it, and I've got a new friend who's been diagnosed years ago with it. Asperger's is a form, I believe, I mean, I'm not an expert by any means, a form of autism. But they're very, very functioning, nice people, friendly, sociopaths and Asperger's don't go hand in hand. So it's an interesting defense, if I might say that, but it certainly doesn't excuse anything, because people with Asperger's aren't criminals. You know, they don't have criminal tendencies any more than someone who's not diagnosed with Asperger's. So I think trying to explain his weirdness and his personality disorder, explaining it away with Asperger's is quite a stretch, and it's a nice try, but I'm not buying it. I think he was showing, you know, he wasn't schizophrenic. You know, he muttered to himself, but mostly he muttered to himself even as a child and as an adult, because he likes to mess with people's minds, and he just does it because he thinks it's fun to mess with people. He was always a loner. You know, and that is not a good sign. He's very intelligent. Could function if he wanted to. And then you have, on the other hand, other side, he's a spoiled brat, you know, growing up. So why work if you don't have to? So he never really poured himself into the Durst organization. And his father was hard on him and on the other boys. So, but they turned out, you know, normal can be. I mean, no one comes out of life unscathed, but, you know, but he was a strict father, and Durst just, you know, was an outsider even inside his own family.
Now, Durst went to UCLA, and he was studying economics, of course, to potentially be able to take over the family dynasty, the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he met Susan Berman. So talk about how these people met and how they became fast friends. What did they have in common? And tell us a little bit about their relationship.
Okay. I believe he went to Lehigh University for his undergraduate. Then he got a master's degree, and he went to UCLA for his doctorate or his master's. I'm sorry, I can't remember which. It's in the book, because I did call the universities and confirm his degrees. He didn't finish at UCLA. He met Susan when she was an undergrad going for journalism before she transferred to UC Berkeley. And they met in the quad, the student quad, and just hit it off immediately. He was a year or two older than her. And immediately they had this bond, always platonic. Neither one of them, you know, neither was interested, you know, romantically in the other. They had instantly a background of wealth, being raised very well. And I mean, she was a trust fund kid, basically, you know, because for the rest of her life, she lived off of, well, until she was 30, she lived off of mob money. And because of her father's interest in hotels. And so she was, you know, she came from wealth. They both lost, he lost one parent, she lost two. They had this instant affinity and this instant connection, and they became lifelong friends. She called him the brother she never had.
Now, when she decides to go into journalism and to be a writer, tell us what Susan Berman writes about specifically.
Well, initially, she was sort of a features writer. She went to work for the San Francisco Examiner and then wrote, and then she freelanced, too. You know, she didn't like going to work and being, you know, stuck day by day having to go to a job. You know, she liked being, she liked freelancing more. And straight out of journalism school at UC Berkeley, she got hired by the San Francisco Examiner and became a features writer. Then, but she didn't like just being a regular reporter along with everybody else. You know, she aspired to do bigger things. And so she started freelancing on the side while she was still at that paper. And she wrote for, I think it was a city paper, and she wrote a story that was titled How to Get Laid in San Francisco. And it was the talk of the town, and it went viral as things could go back then, you know, the old-fashioned way. And, you know, other newspapers wrote about her, and she was always in the society column after that. And she was, and then Bobby had, you know, had left school, and he was back in New York working for his father. And so Susan wanted to, you know, be a journalist in New York, and she got hired by New York Magazine, and she was there when Nicholas Pileggi was a writer there. That's who she worked with. She went and moved to a studio apartment on Beekman Place, which is a real high-end place, but she was just in a little studio. And that was the late 70s, and, you know, mid to late 70s, and she lived in New York for a few years, and Robert Durst introduced her to the literati and, you know, all the movers and shakers and people in the book industry, music industry, and she used to eat at the best restaurants, Elaine's and whatnot, and she wrote a book while she was there called Easy Street, writing, to answer your question, writing about Las Vegas, and she wrote about Las Vegas until her death.
Now, Easy Street was commercially and critically accepted at that time, so it let her continue with her lavish lifestyle, basically.
Yeah, she got a very large. It was it's off the top of my head, but it was like $385,000 or something in advance for with the movie rights. And she that was very exciting. She was on the Today Show for the book. It was very critically, positively reviewed, and she was high in her game, and she didn't want to work at New York Magazine. By that time, she was getting paranoid and had phobias, and one of them was the fear of heights, and she didn't like working in anything off the ground, anything above the first floor, and she was always afraid she'd get too close to a window and fall out, and so she was battling, you know, her phobias at that point. And then in 1982, if you want to take the listeners to that, is, you know, she was there at the time that Robert Durst's wife, Kathy, disappeared.
Now, what was the relationship between the three of them? She was friends with Kathy as well as Bobby. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, Kathy liked her. Yeah, they had mutual friends. I mean, Robert Durst didn't have, I mean, his wife had a lot of friends, and Robert had a lot of acquaintances. And then Susan, because she was a journalist and at a top magazine, she met a lot of people. I mean, they hung around with Lorraine Newman from Saturday Night Live, and just a lot of big name people, you know, in the music and literature industry and journalism. And Bobby just sort of hung out with Susan. You know, at first she hung out with him, and then it became he was just always invited. But Kathy was part of the circle, and she wasn't Susan's friend necessarily, but because she was married to Robert, you know, she was her friend. But Kathy liked Susan. She never felt threatened or anything by her. But the friend said that he was always closer to Susan than he was to his own wife. And then they were having problems. She was in her fourth year of college. He was becoming abusive, and she wanted a divorce. And then she was planning on divorcing as soon as she was finished with school, and she only had, you know, a few months to go. And then, you know, she turned up missing, and they haven't ever found her remains or her. She was declared dead years ago, and then 10 years after she disappeared, Durst divorced her.
Now let's go backwards.
Divorced her, even though she was declared dead.
Let's go back, because this is the complicated part of this, is the relationship Susan has with Bobby Durst and how she becomes his media spokesperson, being a liaison between media and the police. And so that's how close they are as friends. Now,
she did him a big solid. Yeah.
Okay, well, explain how that really works and what exactly did she convey to the media and police as this go-between on behalf of Robert Durst at that time?
Well, Durst didn't report his wife missing for 5 days, and they lived in Westchester County, you know, in New York, but they had an apartment in the city, and he and Kathy had argued, and she was at a friend's house at a party, and it was a Sunday evening, and she said she had to get home. Durst was mad at her, and she was going to take the train to the city to spend the night in their Manhattan apartment so she could get up the next day and go to classes. Well, nobody ever saw her again after she left the party. And then Durst didn't report her missing for 5 days. And then he didn't do it out of his own county in Westchester. He went to Manhattan. I think that was by design. He's a cagey guy. He wanted to put it in a different jurisdiction, and especially in a jurisdiction where his father is a very powerful, well-known man who practically runs Manhattan. So they accepted Durst's explanation, including an alibi at certain times, which he lied and he admitted on, you know, a recent documentary, The Jinx, which is all about him, that just aired, that he had made that up. He admitted lying, while he was on being taped. But so after, because of his name and because of who his family was, the media in New York just took off with the story. So he didn't want to talk to the media. So Susan became his spokesman. And there was also a telephone call the next morning after Kathy disappeared, supposedly from a woman saying she was Kathy Durst, calling the dean of the medical school that she wouldn't be into classes that week or that day. Like, who in college calls a dean? You know, college kids don't have to call in. And if you talk to anybody, it would be a professor to find out how to make up your work. So it was an odd phone call. The doorman couldn't place Kathy Durst in Manhattan. Nobody had seen her in Manhattan. But the Manhattan, you know, the New York PD didn't pursue the case at all. And it just sort of died down. But Susan, everybody believes that because she was the spokesperson, the wide belief is that she knew too much. And she knew too much for a very, very long time.
How could it be that she was able to be the spokesperson? I mean, this is the thing I just don't have an explanation for. How does she have credibility as a spokesperson just because she's his friend and she's a journalist? Is that why they gave her this ability to be the spokesperson rather than having him answer these hard questions? Oh.
Well, he gave her that. It's just like anybody, you know. You look at the Freddie Gray family right now, the guy who was killed in Baltimore when he was in custody
right.
of the police, and it's the family. There's a stepfather who's now coming out front and speaking. It's usually a family member. She was very close to him. She was one of his best friends, so if not his best friend, so it's easy to say I'm his best friend, and he's asked me to, and they accept it. You know, they just accept anybody who can talk to them about it. I think, frankly, he just didn't want to, you know, he was just waiting for it to go away, and it did. And interestingly enough, that was in 82, and Susan, her book had come out in 81, I believe, and that was probably around the time of the film deal, and then that fell through because Susan was difficult to work with, and she wanted to write the screenplay, and so the movie just pulled, it just died. And it never was, filmed. And then in 84, Susan left New York. And I think it all was just, I think Robert Durst changed after that. And he was under suspicion by Westchester County, you know, for committing murder. But they didn't have a body. They didn't have any evidence. They didn't work with Manhattan PD. Nobody really pursued it, but he was always considered a person of interest. And I think it changed him. And then she left and went to L.A. to become a screenwriter, which never happened.
Now, with this...
But she stayed in touch with Bobby, of course.
What was the alibi that she provided for Bobby Durst, can you say?
Well, what he said, he had left and went to a neighbor's house and had a drink with him. And no, the police didn't even question him about whether he did, that he'd taken his wife to the train station. In fact, when everybody knows he was out of town, because there were phone calls made from, it's called Ship Bottom, New York, or Ship Bottom, New Jersey, I think it is. And it's a little distance from his Westchester house. And he was actually had called the Durst organization later when people looked into the records and everything. They found out, the police, that someone had made phone calls from Ship Bottom calling collect. And the only one who could do that from there would have been Bobby Durst. And so they place him there. So he obviously wasn't home, wasn't having a drink with his neighbor, but they never called the neighbor. So the neighbor appears on the documentary and goes, yeah, no, I never had a drink with him. But Susan's alibi was more, hers was more to place Kathy in New York, going to school, making a phone call from Manhattan to the school to put her there in town, to take it out of Westchester. And put it into Manhattan, where they were not pursuing it. So it was, you know, and he was just, and then he didn't report his wife missing for 5 years, which is odd.
Yeah. Now,
it's all convoluted, you know.
Now, in many cases, is there another woman in the offing dimension?
Well, yes, eventually, Deborah, what is her last name?
Cataran.
Yes. She's a pricey, well-known realtor who befriends him in the 80s, 85 or something, and becomes romantically involved with him at some point. But so you figure, okay, if you backtrack and you go, okay, 1982, there's a missing person, probably a murder. Then you go 2000, there's a murder with Susan Berman. Then you go... you fast forward to 2002, and there's a murder of in Galveston Bay. And in between Susan and Galveston Bay, this Deborah Charlton, I mean, I think actually he married her at some point around Christmas time, around the time Susan was murdered. And he did it because he was on the lam, because the police had leaked, unfortunately, they had leaked that they were interested in, it was around November of 2000, they were interested in talking to Durst, to Susan, about what she knew way back in 1982 about the Kathy Durst case and her disappearance. And it came out in a magazine, and Durst bolted, left the state, went to New Orleans, went to Galveston Bay, you know, went undercover, wore women's clothing, got a $300 apartment next door to Morris Black in this rundown apartment building in Galveston Bay, and tried to live incognito. And all the while, Susan, you know, was trying to get in touch with him. And she couldn't. This is before. So that came out about October, November. And Susan was killed on December 23rd. And, you know, but he had a house in San Francisco. And, you know, he was always traveling, living someplace else. So he was traveling to San Francisco, too, and nobody even knew it, you know.
Let's talk about...
Not until later.
Let's talk about the district attorney. What is the evidence, or who is the witness, or tell us what spurns the district attorney to reopen the case and specifically want to interview Susan Berman as we've mentioned in the introduction, about that phone call supposedly made after a day after the disappearance. So tell us what spurns this refocus on Susan Berman.
So it was a detective. It was friends of Kathy Durst, a couple of friends who kept hounding the police department in Westchester, telling them, you've got to, you know, here's the evidence. They were going through his trash. They found notes. I mean, they were trying to do everything they could. I mean, the police didn't even go into Bobby Durst's house until years later. He had sold it, and the house he shared with Kathy Durst. And they didn't do anything. I mean, there was a pond that was frozen, but in Ship Bottom, you could break through, and that's where everybody thinks she was dumped. But they dragged some ponds at some lake at some point years later. But so he was, you know, it all died down, and then it lit up. His name was Becerra, Detective Becerra, got fired up because of the friends saying, you know, you've got to chase this case down. And you need to talk to Susan Berman because she was his spokesperson and his best friend. And if anybody knew anything, it would be Susan. And so they contacted Susan. But what they did, what leaked out, was that it leaked out to the media, and then it became public. And then Durst got, you know, tipped off that they wanted to talk to Susan, and they had already contacted her, but she hadn't returned their calls. So they never had a chance to talk to Susan, and I think whatever she knew, you know, died with her in the grave. So then he freaked out and was on the lam, and then she had told friends that Robert Durst had called her and said he was going to come and visit. He was going to be in California, in northern Nevada, northern California, at his house. He had a condo and a house up there. And that he was going to come down and visit her, and I think he did. And he killed her.
Sorry, Kathy. We're going to use this as a pause for a message from our sponsor, which is NatureBox. And you know you're going to snack, and when you do, you want it to be worth it. Something that is tasty and satisfying but doesn't make you feel guilty afterwards. What you need are snacks from NatureBox. Choose from over 100 healthy and crave-worthy options to be delivered right to your door. All of their snacks are all made with zero artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, 0 grams trans fats, and no high fructose corn syrup. And best of all, they taste amazing. So good and so much better for you than the other snack options out there. So next time you're hungry, grab sriracha roasted cashews, white truffle popcorn, and peanut butter nom noms, or personalize to your favorites, and get smart about snacking. Right now, if you go to naturebox.com/truemurder, you can get a free trial of their favorite snacks. Free snacks delivered right to your door. What are you waiting for? Go to naturebox.com/truemurder to get your free trial today. When we last left off, Kathy, we were speaking about all of the evidence surrounding Bobby Durst in terms of connection to Susan Berman's murder, in terms of afterwards where he is, you say he's on the lam. Let's go back to the actual murder itself. And because, again, police, like you have mentioned a couple times, are not so eager, not so diligent, not so anxious to go after Bobby Durst. So tell us about Susan Berman's murder and how anyone discovers that she's actually been killed and when.
It was December, December, the night of December 22nd, between 9 p.m., and the morning of December 23rd, because her dogs were running loose in the front yard, and then the neighbors heard the dogs barking the night before, which could have been they were barking at Durst. So on the 22nd, she had gone out to dinner with a friend and out to the show and got home somewhere around 9:30, 10, 9 o'clock, something like that. And that person was interviewed, of course, and cleared. So Susan was paranoid. She never in a million years would have opened her door to anybody. So it had to be someone she knew. And she was killed with a 9mm single gunshot wound to the back of her head as she was walking through her hallway to her spare room, which is where she had three small dogs. And she had, and two of them didn't get along, so she would have to crate one or the other. And they were in that spare room where she would crate them. And she was walking into that spare room, so she didn't know what was coming. She didn't know she was about to be shot. And her body, curiously, was turned over because, you know, when you're shot in the back of the head, there's a little bit of recoil, but you fall forward. And she was turned over in an unusual position, not a natural falling position, and a pool of blood. And so the next door neighbors, the next morning, I interviewed the neighbors, and especially the one next door, he's a doctor, and he saw them out loose in Benedict Canyon Road, where she lived on the border of Los Angeles and Beverly Hills. It was heavily trafficked, no sidewalks or anything, and just fast traffic. I was just there recently, but nobody did anything. The neighbors next door noticed as well, and the one of the dogs they let come into their house, the other neighbors on the other side. I can't remember the doctor's name, but the doctor gets up the next morning on the 24th, and lo and behold, the dogs are out again. So he walks over, talks to the neighbors on the other side, because it was unusual to see these dogs out. And they notice that through her gate is open and her back door is ajar, which means that the killer went out the back way. I think he was parked up the street where you can park, and they walked in the cover of night, you know, on the 22nd. And then people called police, and that was around, police didn't get there till around just before noon on New Year's Eve day. So you figure the Wilshire LAPD station responded, detectives, but they didn't call homicide. And there was a poster above Susan's mantle, the wanted poster for her father from the 1920s, wanted for murder. And they figured it was a mob hit. Single gunshot wound to the back of the head. So they didn't process it like a typical crime scene. And I think the holiday had something to do with it. And they did not call in homicide. Homicide didn't catch the case for 2.5 weeks. Almost 3 weeks went by. And you know how that is. The first 48 hours, of course, are the most important. So, and then friends called the house looking for her because she didn't show up at a dinner. Christmas Eve dinner, and so they were worried about her. Police answered the phone, so word started spreading among her family and her cousins and her stepson, and people started coming to the house. So people were just, they let them in. So the crime scene was like the O.J. Simpson scene, where there's so many people trampling all over it. So that's where that stood. And then Durst was, of course, gone.
Now let's talk about that with the prosecution just about to interview Susan Berman. And did anybody make the connection that Robert Durst might be a person of interest? And then we have you can tell us about the funeral. And of course we see this in the movies all the time, where the police are observing the funeral just in case the killer might show up.
And
what's interesting about really good friend that walked her down the aisle.
Yeah.
Tell us about Robert Durst's non-appearance at this. And also talk about what's very interesting is the odd behavior of her manager, Niall Brenner. And did that
Yeah,
add
Niall
to the-
was a, yeah, he was a suspect. And he was her quasi-manager because she never paid him. And she owed him money. And so he waited for police to leave and then climb through her windows, and you know there's fingerprint everywhere, and he took some bank statements. He said he took them and then he returned them later to police, but he was a suspect too. But they didn't search his house for, it was like 2 months went by and they searched his house and didn't find anything. And but Durst was, he offered to pay for the funeral, and the cousin who handled the funeral turned him down on that because they got a sense of, I guess he was very nice to everybody on the phone. The stepson supported Durst, visited him in jail later in Galveston Bay, and, you know, he was acquitted of that murder based on a weird self-defense, ploy, and it worked. But he, so there was just, and then the landlady, they looked at her because she had threatened to kill Susan's dog or something. She was like 81 years old. Susan was in the midst of being evicted. She needed money. She went to Durst. Durst sent her two $25,000 checks for a total of $50,000. I think he always did it. I don't think he was trying to pay her off. Maybe he was trying to pay off her silence. But I don't know that she would have threatened him, but she was very, very desperate. But she couldn't get a hold of him. He was sort of incognito, and she was frustrated. So, and Susan would lash out at people verbally sometimes. So who knows how that conversation with him went. In order to get him and ask for money, she had to write a letter to the Durst organization, and then they got in touch with him when he was in Galveston Bay. In the meantime, 10 months later, he kills his next-door neighbor, chops him up and puts him in little bags, and he floats up, the body floats up in Galveston Bay.
How does he end up in Galveston Bay? You talked about
he's
him
just
being
looking.
On the run.
Yeah.
So what does
well,
he
well, they
do?
Thought, go ahead.
You talk about him being in this little flea-bitten apartment, which is important because he gets bail because they don't recognize who he is. So
yeah,
tell
they
us
arrest
about
him
this.
And they don't recognize. Yeah, they don't recognize him, but they refer to Galveston Bay as the end of the road because it's actually the road into Galveston Bay ends at the bay, and it's a small town. They don't have a homicide unit. Durst was, then he, after he killed Morris Black, then he takes off and he goes to Lehigh, Pennsylvania, where he graduated from college. He likes to revisit places he used to be in, it's interesting. So he goes to Lehigh, goes into a drugstore. He's got $35,000 cash in his car, $500 in his pocket, and a 9mm gun. Gee, that's what Susan was killed with. In the back of his trunk, but he goes into this drugstore and steals a Band-Aid, puts it on his mouth of all things, above his nose, above his lip, and walks out with a sandwich and a newspaper, and they get him for shoplifting, and that's when they arrested him, and someone pulled him up in the computer and realized who he was, and he lawyered up immediately, but he. When asked why he stole the sandwich, because I wanted to. And I think that just speaks volumes of him, don't you? He thinks he's above the lies, a spoiled kid, do whatever, money and power. His father, by the way, Seymour Durst, had hired an attorney, and that attorney called the LAPD and called the DA's office and also wrote a letter to the DA's office. Leave him alone. Quit questioning. Quit trying to interview him. Quit calling him. And so they did. So the power of, fear of being, I don't know, losing your job because the high-powered person comes along and complains about you to your bosses. I don't know. So they backed away from him completely. And Susan's case just languished until 2012. When they reinvestigated the LAPD based upon a missing girl in San Francisco who was last seen with a guy who looked like Robert Durst, the FBI got involved because that involves kidnapping because she was seen getting into a car that was like his. And the FBI, in concert with the LAPD, opened it, reopened the case, I think, and then thus the arrest in 2015. So this started in 2012, 2013, and so it's not like the jinx prompted it. It was in the works, but I think it speeded up his arrest because the FBI works very slowly when they're investigating things, but they. I think the LAPD, as far as evidence goes, I think they've got great ballistics right now on that 9mm shell that was found in Susan's house. I would bet
right. It's
close, because Galveston Bay said, oh, it was inconclusive, but that's Galveston Bay. You know, do they even have a crime lab of their own? So the LAPD didn't test it, but I bet it's already been to Quantico, Virginia, to the FBI, and that it's been tested by the LAPD's lab. And I think they've got a lot. And, you know, they've got lots of circumstantial. They placed in financial records. In my book, I've reported financial records show him in Los Angeles, not just San Francisco. He flew out of San Francisco the afternoon she was found, and his attorney, Dick DeGuerin, one of the best in the country, told me he had an alibi for Susan Berman's death, that he was in the air. And I said, well, wait a minute, what day was it? He was in the air after her body was found, when she had been dead for, you know, for 24 to 36 hours. So he had plenty of time to drive back to San Francisco and then get that flight out on the 24th.
While we're talking about this type of interesting evidence, tell us about the cadaver letter. And this was the letter notifying police that there was a body at Susan Berman's house. That's how there was a letter sent to police, and that was called what we refer in your book to as the cadaver letter. So tell us about the cadaver letter and then the handwriting analysis or comparison that seemed to be part of the HBO The Jinx series about Robert Goodson.
Yeah, on December 23rd, a postcard, well, it was an envelope with a note inside that said cadaver in Susan's address and Beverly Hills, and Beverly Hills was spelled wrong with an extra E.
Right.
And then the envelope block letters on the front of the envelope to the Beverly Hills. All it said was Beverly Hills Police, postmarked December 23rd in Los Angeles, and they sent it to the wrong jurisdiction, of course, the killer did, and no one could have written it except for the killer, because it was postmarked the day before a body was found. And so it's obviously the killer, and I think Durst just likes to mess with people again. You know, I don't think it was because he cared. Her body was in there, you know, deteriorating. I think it's just, he just does things just because. I think he thinks he pulls the wool over people's eyes and he's just messing with them. Hey, guess what? You've got a body over there. And so in the HBO documentary, Sarah Kaufman, who was Susan's stepson, quasi-stepson. She lived with his father for a long time and then helped raise his two children. So he's an adult, of course. So Sarah was given papers from the LAPD of Susan's, you know, personal records, manuscripts, things like that in a box. And the film, years ago, the police, now you get that, right? The police had apparently gone through them. I don't know if they went through them, but they gave them to them. I think it's sloppy police work because they missed it.
Sure.
So the filmmaker then asked, hey, could you go through the stuff and, you know, one more time and just see if there is anything interesting. And he calls, Sarah calls the filmmaker and says, oh my God, he's shaking, he's upset, can somebody come over? He found this envelope from the Durst organization stationary in block letters, just like the cadaver letter, Beverly Hills to Susan Berman. I guess he thought she was in Beverly Hills. She was really in Los Angeles, right on the border. So same misspelling, same letters, same everything, handwriting analysis so far. Three of them say that it matches Durst's handwriting. But earlier, Durst police had asked for one when he was in jail in Galveston. They'd asked, LAPD had asked for handwriting. And, of course, he wrote cursive. You know, he didn't write in block letters, and they couldn't. It was inconclusive. But these are dead-on matches right now. So they confronted Durst with those, and then we all know what happens after that in the documentary, of course, right?
Well, tell us, for those people that didn't see it, I happened to catch it, of course, because of your book and interviewing you.
Thank
and then,
you.
Like a lot of people, I said, wow, I'll get to see this. And I just happened to see all of it and happened to see that last episode. I hadn't even planned on it. And I just happened to see it where he's muttering to himself. So tell us about the HBO series, why there was interest, and what they – tell us, like, the format of the show for those people that didn't get to see it yet. Tell us about the Jinx.
Well, there was the movie, The Good – was it called The All Good Things? Is that what it was called?
All Good Things.
There's a movie.
Yes.
Okay, a movie about Kathy Durst and her disappearance, and Ryan Gosling played the lead. He played Robert Durst. And the filmmaker was Andrew Jarecki. And Durst liked the film. And he called the filmmaker afterward and said, hey, I like the film. Why don't you do a documentary on me? And so they talked, and they got together with Durst, the filmmaker, and another producer, got together with Durst and his attorney and sat down. And over months and months, it took a long time, they settled on that he was going to do this documentary. They interviewed him something like 24 hours, was it, or 23 hours of tape. And in the process of doing that, and then over, I think it took a couple of years to do it. I think I came very close to being interviewed, and then they never called me. I was told that I was on the list, but I wanted to say anything positive, because if you look at the early series, it's a six-part series, and the first three are very sympathetic toward Durst. I'd like to see the contract they had with him. I think it's because his attorney is now saying the filmmakers double-crossed him. So in the sixth episode, which is, the big one, a fifth one was about Susan, which was fascinating. Then the last one is Sarah discovering, of course, on film, he discovered it beforehand, and then they put it on film, and he had his reaction. Right. This envelope with the Durst organization, letterhead, and then the exact words. So they asked Durst, confronted him, Jarecki did, the filmmaker. And he said, oh, well, yeah, the only one who could have written the cadaver letter is the killer. He admitted that. And then he said, but, that's not, that's just anybody could do that. It's like a typewriter. You write block letters and they all look alike. And then he took away the he had printed them. The filmmaker had printed the two Beverly Hills on one piece of paper, one above the other, and said, which one is yours? And Durst couldn't tell him, couldn't recognize his own handwriting, because they both are his handwriting, of course. So Durst excused himself, said he had to use the restroom, gets up, he's still on mic, goes in and says, what have you done? This is a disaster. What have you done? Killed them all, of course. And they've got that on tape. It's more of an admission, I think, than a confession, but it speaks volumes.
Yeah, it's interesting. Let's go back just a little bit. I wanted to, because we didn't talk about his, when he's on the run and he's trying to go incognito, we've heard countless tales of people getting aliases and having new lives, but this guy does it to a whole new other level. So let's talk a little bit about this cross-dressing, and that's even bizarre, and this mute disguise that he has so that he can't talk to police. And also we'll talk a little bit about Morris Black.
He's an oddball too, but Morris Black apparently had ties to the mob, and Bobby Baca believes that there's a connection, between the mob, and that they found out something to do with Susan, but her father didn't have anything to do with those people. Plus, her father's been dead since 1957. So, Susan, the only ties she had was she got, money over the years until she was 30, and then it all ended because she was paid whatever his interests were. And that was, of course, the Chicago connection. It's certainly nothing to do with Morris Black and his family. But Morris, Durst claims that they got into an argument and Morris had a gun and they scuffled and it accidentally went off and killed Morris. And then he just panicked, so he went and got a chainsaw and chopped him up. And in a panic, I don't know how you can chop up your own species. Right. I have a hard time chopping up a chicken, but yeah. I don't do that anymore. So he there's blood everywhere, in the apartment. And then he's living as a mute woman, but apparently he let his guard down with Morris. So maybe that was it. He let his guard down and started talking to him. And so Morris knew that he was living as, you know, as a woman, and he was on the run. So that could have been the motivation as well, because you've got motive, opportunity, and means, you know, and he certainly had everything. So that could be connected, that he found out too, like Susan knew too much, and so he did him in. But then he, you know, they never found Morris Black's head, so they couldn't say how he was killed, although he says he was shot in the front of the head. I think he was shot in the back of the head, just like Susan. So the head disappeared, and of course he got rid of the head, because that would have been terrible evidence. So without that, the jury acquitted him. The self-defense theory, and you know, Dick DeGaren, one of the top defense attorneys in the country, represented him, and now I guess he's representing him again in New Orleans, where he was arrested, by the way, with a mask of an old person and a wig. So he was going to do the same thing, apparently, only had a map of Cuba with him and passports and about 20 different IDs, all illegal, different names.
Isn't it fascinating that Dick DeGaren puts Robert Durst in California at the time of his wife's murder? So as clever as he is, and as accommodating it is for his client, he's not done any good for him in this case, has he?
No, and then they've had that confirmed, of course, with the, you know, the flight that he took out. It was actually, I believe, a 10 p.m. flight out of San Francisco on December 24th. And plenty of time from the 22nd or the morning of the 23rd when she was killed, somewhere around there, according to rigor mortis in her body. You know, that she had been dead for, you know, 24 to 36 hours. And so they now have financial records placing him leaving. They've got about 200 miles outside of, or 100 or so miles outside of, south of San Francisco area, they've got him checking his voicemail. So they've got a ping on his cell phone, and then they don't have anything on him until the 24th back in California, other than back in Northern California. So Susan's murder happens, all of a sudden he's quiet on his cell phone and everything else. But I'm told that there are financial records, I was told by a San Francisco investigator, and I had it confirmed with the LAPD, that they've got financial records that place Durst in the Los Angeles area, which is gas or something. He slipped up somehow. And because he does that, you know, crooks get caught because they got, you know, they're stupid and they make a mistake. You know, trying to cover something up, it's hard enough living, isn't it? Trying to do everything the right way and everything you do, let alone having to manufacture stuff. That's hard to do. And so you trip yourself up, and he's getting older. Good thing is, he's not in very good health.
You talked about Los Angeles police, we'll just say, for lack of a better term, dropping the ball on this. But in terms of the FBI... have they seemed to put, as far as you know, seemed to put everything together in terms of Kathy Durst murdered, Susan Berman has the alibi, going to be questioned, murdered, and then we certainly can see what he did to his capability of murdering, dismembering, covering up his crime. Does it seem like they have a good handle on the nexus of events and enough to really convict Robert Durst this time?
I do. I think they do. But I think the important thing is he was caught in New Orleans, you know, about to leave the country, apparently, with a gun. And he was convicted of a felony being on the lam, you know, because he did flee justice. So he was convicted of that. So he's a convicted felon. He had two firearms with him. He had 5 kilos of marijuana, 5 ounces. Kilos, 5 ounces of marijuana with him in New Orleans. That's a felon with a weapon and a illegal substance. So they're going to, that could get him 10 to 20. So LAPD is not pushing it because that's a federal case now. The state case on that was dropped. So the feds are focusing in New Orleans because they can get him on that, no doubt. And then his attorney wants to get him in L.A., of course, but they also want to get rid of that federal case in New Orleans. So once he gets to L.A., I think they've got a heck of a case. I really do. Interesting thing is one of his friends, he met him in Houston at a Starbucks. This guy contacted me last week, said, I'm a friend of, he sent me a message through, I can't remember which social media site it was, it might have been LinkedIn, that a friend of Robert Durst wants to talk to you, which sent a, you know, a chill up my spine. So I figured, what the heck? So I took my GPS off my phone, turned it off, and called. And so he wanted to know where I was. And he said what I think he was trying to change my mind. It wasn't like he was trying to pick my brain. He was trying to change my mind on Durst, you know, to claim that he's innocent. This is what he's going after, is someone impersonated, tried to set up Durst, went into killed Susan Berman and then tried to set up Durst and killed her because there's no motive to kill her. She didn't have any money or anything. Nothing was taken from the house. And that rifled through her things, found the letter that Durst had written her, and then copied the handwriting and copied it as the cadaver letter. So it was forged in his handwriting. It wasn't his because someone wanted to set him up. It's so far-fetched. It's laughable, and I blogged about it. And then, you know, the whole, it's amazing to me, but I think his guys are just putting their heads together, his defense team, trying to come up with something as creative as the self-defense in Galveston Bay. It was brilliant, and it worked, didn't it?
Well, absolutely. You get it is testament to the incredible kind of defense that you get. And again, I won't go back into my, you know, rant about that, but in terms of being able to defend yourself after the body parts are found in Galveston Bay, then he has enough time to come up with, again, creative defense. The only defense that's left, because there's no head, of course, there's no forensic evidence of how that person was killed.
Uh-huh.
But that's usually not a good enough defense to be able to provide at trial and to be acquitted. But when you have a great lawyer, but what I found fascinating with this story is that Dick DeGuerin, this veteran lawyer, really screws up with this inadvertent admission for an alibi for his client. And so,
oh, and he told me, he said, that's off the record. And I said, no, you didn't. And I've interviewed him at length because of the Binion trial in Las Vegas, because he was on that case for a while. So I've been in a courtroom with him. And I said, no, you didn't tell me before you said that it was off the record. I mean, it was on the record. And he realized the second he said it, he goes, oh, wait a minute. He realized it. But then they were able to confirm that, you know. I mean, I broke that in the book, but they were able to confirm that with his records. You know, he buys things with credit cards. He gets, you know, when you fly, you have to use your name. Otherwise, if you don't, you're flying, you know, it's illegal to do that if you get found out using a false ID and everything. It's a big penalty. There are federal laws against that. So he flew, he always flew as himself that we know of. So yeah, we've got him flying in and out of San Francisco around the time of her death. And it's just, he's powerful and rich and thinks he's the smartest person in the room. And, you know, he's not as cagey as he thinks because he just got caught, didn't he?
Why did he kill Susan Berman, in your mind?
I think Susan did know a lot, and I think that he didn't, you know, he didn't necessarily trust her anymore. He was out of touch with her. She was anxious to get a hold of him. Who knows what their conversations were like. And I think he killed her to shut her up in case the, police wanted, because they did want to talk to her, and he knew that they were going to. Eventually, and I think he shut her up, so any information she had at all was the one thing she could have told them was that she was the one who made the phone call to the school to try to place Kathy Durst in Manhattan, you know, and I mm-hmm. think that was the most damning thing probably, but who knows what else she knew. I mean, she told friends that, I know Bobby did it, I know that he killed Kathy Durst, but but he's my Bobby, you know. Her father was a killer, and she adored her father, even though she knew what his background, you know, at his high level in Las Vegas, he never killed anybody himself. He may have ordered it, but he didn't. He no longer killed. But when, in his younger years, he did, and he did some time for one murder. And so it's almost like Susan was anesthetized to it, and so she accepted it. She accepted it, and then the Omerta thing with the mob. So he had, I don't think she would have ratted on him, but I think it was the phone call to the dean that would have taken away placing her, that would have negated that. And then who else, or whatever else she knew. Because, you know, she no doubt knew that he killed his wife. He also had some dogs and kept naming them Igor, and said on tape, and it's in the Jinx, you know, he said to his wife, Deborah Sheraton, that he, you know, they better watch out, I'll Igor them. Like it's an active verb, Igor, the dog's name. He had like 10 dogs, and they kept dying of none naturally. So there's thought out there that he was practicing to kill Kathy by killing his dog Igor, and then he'd just go get another one, and then that one would die, and he'd go get another one. You know, so it's all creepy. It's all very creepy. But now he's in jail where he should be, and you've got one more killer off the street, at least for now.
What's really telling is the, despite the Durst organization, like you say, at one time rallying around their son to say, listen, police, don't question this guy, leave this guy alone, Douglas Durst, which is the head of the foundation now, spoke to HBO about Robert Durst and his suspicions about Robert Durst. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that he wasn't speaking to HBO. Those were I think they did get him, but part of the tapes were depositions because Durst was stalking his family and they were afraid of him.
Right.
You know, he went and urinated, he eliminated his bladder in a store, Durst did, just because, and got off on that. You know, that he was acquitted of that. And then this stalking thing, I think that was dismissed. And they're afraid of him. They've got temporary restraining orders. So upon his arrest, they were just hugely relieved. But, yeah, he said they had fights. And then his brother talked about being afraid of him. And then Durst they cut away in the Jinx to Durst. And Durst observing this in the film, you know, seeing his brother saying he's afraid of him. And Durst laughing, going, yeah, I don't know why he's afraid of me. He's been afraid of me ever since we were little boys. You know, and it's he's a creep, you know. And they were at Thanksgiving dinner one year. It was like 2013 or something, or 12. They look up, and, you know, these people have a lot of money. So they live in the States, or they live in you know, they own the whole walk-up, you know. It's not just one apartment, you know, but in Manhattan. And he's just standing at their window looking at them as they're sitting at the dining room table having dinner. You know, he's creeped them all out. And he just does that because he likes to get a reaction out of people. So he's a creepy guy, and I'm glad he's behind bars, and I hope he dies in jail. That, you know, he may not make it to L.A. because he's a very sick man right now, apparently. He's in New Orleans, you know. You've been to New Orleans?
No, but I know he's
good old boy
sort of
down
a,
there. It's a good old, yeah, it's a, the jails aren't fun down
looks
there.
Good
there.
No.
Yeah, it's a whole new world down deep
there.
South. So
yeah.
They're not impressed with money.
Let me ask this question for the authority on all things Susan Berman and Robert Durst, by virtue of your incredible, inexplicable connection with this story.
Thank you.
Do you believe that Susan Berman knew, you alluded to it just a little bit ago, so I'm fascinated. So did Susan Berman know that her friend Robert Durst had killed his wife? And do you believe that she was the one that made that call, posing as Catherine Durst to the dean of the school the next day?
I think she's absolutely the one who made the phone call. And as far as knowing that he killed Kathy, I think she suspected it. If she had any evidence, we'll never know, or if he told her directly. But I think she absolutely suspected it, and she forgave him. You know, she loved him like a brother, she told everybody, and she would have forgiven him of anything. She knew her father was a killer, and it didn't freak her out. And I think that because he was a very loving father, and so she felt he was a loving friend, and I think she would have forgiven Bobby Durst for anything. And I think that's why he kept her around. And along came the second wife, and she was the same way, only she was a powerful real estate agent, and she just believed everything he told her. And I think she knew a lot. I think she absolutely knows a lot too. But he married her right before he went to trial in Galveston, and everybody says it was because of the protection of marriage. You can't testify right against the spouse, and that's why they married, because they never really lived as man and wife. He's a difficult person to live with. So, yes, I believe if she didn't know he killed his wife, I think she knew too much, and he knew that she knew too much, and that was the motive for killing her.
Oh, that's incredible.
And it's a shame, you know, because Susan was, she had a sad life, you know, in so many ways, and she was trying so hard to make it, and she had, you know, very big years, very high years, and very low years. But she went through something like $5.4 million from the mob, and that you could, you know, that would go a lifetime and then some had she invested it, because back then, you know, when she was 30 and she got the last payment, that was, what year would that have been? She was born in 46, so if it's 76, I mean, that's a lot of money. And Susan just blew through it. She wasn't given the tools to live as a child, and I think that's what happened to Durst. Neither one of them, because of their wealth, and they never had to work, they never had to have a paper route. Everything was given to them. And then Susan, of course, did have to make a living later, but she didn't have the tools. They weren't given to her growing up. And I don't think they were given to Durst as well. And they couldn't function in regular, you know, and in some ways they were very much alike, only, of course, she wasn't a killer. But, you know, she was very dysfunctional. I don't think she was sociopathic. He, of course, is. I'm no psychiatrist, but, you know, it's human behavior. But he's one messed up dude. But she fell for it all. And would have, I think, Dan, she would have forgiven him for killing her. I think she would have forgiven him for it. Well, you know what I mean? Because she would have forgiven him of anything. And he was a fool because he didn't trust his friendship with her enough. And there's no reason to kill her. Because I don't think she would have given him up. You know, so that's sort of the... Yeah, that's the sad part about it.
Yeah. Well, it's an incredible
story, too.
Yeah, it's an incredible story, too, that where she starts off with her father has such influence. I found this one of the more fascinating little anecdotes was she said to her father, I love Elvis Presley, and if you're such a big, important guy, you'll get him to sing me Happy Birthday. So he did. He got Elvis Presley to come and sing at her 12th birthday, if you can imagine that effect, sing Happy Birthday and sign a note to her. Wow. So that's how powerful Davy Berman was at that time. And the kind of charm
Liberace,
life she did have.
Yeah, Liberace and all those guys, Jack Benny. I mean, it was everybody and you know, she, anybody. And then she'd have a limousine come pick her up. She had only one friend on her street. And Pat Bailey, and he's heavy in the book. You know, I interviewed him at length, and they would get picked up in a limousine to go to her birthday parties, and she didn't have any kids to invite to her birthday parties, so her father would invite all his casino workers' families or the executives. All the kids would come. And they're kids that she didn't know very well. One of them was Bob Miller, who grew up to be a governor. And he said, well, I only saw her at birthday parties or in the swimming pool. You know, he was a couple of years older than her, and he became governor of Nevada. But and she stayed in touch with him, you know. So it was interesting. In some ways, that life was very idyllic, and they were in parades down, you know, down Fremont Street when she was young. but in some ways it harmed her because she never was able to really make it on her own. She wasn't given the tools, life tools that you get, you know, when you're growing up.
Well, they also, your book's account too, and all accounts, she was became more and more paranoid and difficult, and had, you know, rows with many, many people, and it seemed like Bobby Durst, you know, you can't have any more testament to a certain type of personality when your family's afraid of you and your father doesn't entrust you with the company, gives it to the youngest son, not the oldest son. So both of these people, by virtue of their circumstances, their parents dying, or in this case, Bobby Durst's mother dying at a young age, all the combination of being spoiled and not having to do some of the things that normal people have to do, they end up inextricably involved, friends at first, and then just
both damaged.
Two people involved.
Both damaged, yeah.
Yeah,
and I think
incredible.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Kathy.
Well, I think she was damaged goods, but I think both of them, but definitely Susan, in analyzing her, she was stunted emotionally. It's almost like her feet were firmly planted at 12 years old in Las Vegas, and she never could shake it. You know, she never, she was always searching for something. She always wanted to write about Las Vegas. It's like she wanted to return, and she'd always tell people, you were my father. She never thought her father was famous enough. Well, he is, you know, because of her, and now she's becoming a household name. And Susan always wanted to be somebody and be famous, and now she is, and it's interesting that it's because of her death. I mean, she had made a name for herself, but she was long forgotten. You know, so it, in her younger years, she'd made a name for herself. But now, of course, you know, she goes down in history but she wanted, she thought her dad was such a big person in the mob, but, you know, he kept a low profile. You know, it wasn't Tony Spilotro who got killed because he had too much of a big mouth. You know, the mob got rid of him. But Davey kept a low profile. He was a gentleman. He had a good reputation in town. He was not, you know, he was a philanthropist. They, you know, the mob walked among everybody in Las Vegas back then, and their names were in the phone book, and they ran the town. And she was used to that, and she thought he was such a big person, and he ran the Flamingo. Why wasn't his name bigger? You know, she'd look him up in books, and there'd just be a mention of him. So now her dad's famous too, isn't he?
And so is her good friend and killer, Bobby Durst. And it's indicative, too, of him contacting HBO, interested in immortalizing himself in some kind of documentary. Maybe he can get his dream to come full circle, and he can get a movie about himself as well. Maybe he'll get a leading man who doesn't quite look like he does at 72.
Ego got in the way, didn't it? His ego got in the way.
Yeah, thank God for the narcissism of these people that eventually it's to their undoing.
Yes.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Kathy, very much for coming on and talking about Murder of a Mafia Daughter, and congratulations on the re-release of that book again with new information. And Murder of a Mafia Daughter, the story behind the suspicions, Robert Durst murdered Susan Berman. Thank you very much, Kathy.
My pleasure. Thank you. And it's pre-selling, by the way, on Amazon. Thank you very much.
Absolutely, Kathy. Thank you very much. And you have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Good night. This episode of True Murder is over, and that means it's time to get free snacks at your door from naturebox.com. With over 100 options to choose from, get the bold flavors you crave and feel smarter about snacking. Go to naturebox.com/truemurder to start your free trial. That's naturebox.com/truemurder for your free trial of NatureBox.